Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. For a good century, Americans told a certain kind of immigrant story about coming, striving, and making it in a land of opportunity. And for millions of mostly European immigrants, that story held up. They became homeowners, citizens, and white. But as post-1965 immigrants have looked back on their lives, counter-narratives are emerging, especially for people of color. We'll talk with the author of a new book about his Filipino family's fortunes, and then Omicron. We'll get an update on the latest variant making global headlines. That's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Family stories, especially ones that span continents and classes, are almost always complex. Albert Samaha's story runs from the Philippines to the Bay Area. His mother has gone down the QAnon rabbit hole. He's an investigative journalist. His uncle was an emerging pop star back home and a baggage handler at the airport in San Francisco. After tackling all kinds of topics, his latest book, Concepcion, is an attempt to tell his family's story as one piece of the larger tapestry of Filipino migration to the U.S. And he joins us today to talk about this book. Welcome, Albert.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, tell us about your Bay Area. Like, what's your map? I know you moved around a lot as a kid and your family's got roots in different places. What's that look like for you?
Yeah, all over. And I think it kind of reflects a lot of people in terms of kind of the eastward migration over the course of the 90s and 2000s. We initially moved my family to San Francisco when my mom was pregnant. That's where my grandmother and my auntie, my eldest auntie, lived. And then right around the time I was born was when they moved to Vallejo in the Northeast Bay. That's where I was born. We moved back to San Francisco after that and then moved down to San Mateo a couple years later before moving to Sacramento for when I was in middle school. So kind of spanning all over Northern California.
Wow. And of those places, like, what do you think really influenced your view of sort of like, what is this place that I live in?
You know, interestingly, I think all that movement really opened my eyes to the world beyond my own horizon. I went to like six different schools from kindergarten to high school. And I think it sort of allowed me to see that kind of, there were all these other aspects to the world that I wasn't necessarily aware of. One school I went to, you know, was a very diverse school with a lot of Filipino, Black, Mexican, Chinese kids. Another school I'd go to was all just white kids. Another school I'd go to would be mostly Black and Mexican kids. And I sort of began to create this tapestry in my mind of kind of how wide not just California, but America was, and how much I didn't know, because I'd go from one school where I thought all the coolest kids I knew went to that school, then go to the next school and meet some other cool kids. And it just sort of opened my eyes to kind of how diverse even just the Bay Area was.
Yeah. I mean, you think that's kind of the seeds of what eventually and is now your job, both an investigative journalist and the inequality editor at BuzzFeed News.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think when people ask me like how I sort of first wanted to be journalist, I think a lot of it came from dropping into new schools at a young age and having to figure out for myself what the new social dynamic was, what the etiquettes were, how to sort of blend in while still getting people to like me and getting myself in a place where I would meet kids and have to, you know, basically like do the same thing I do now, which is like cold call people and hope that they like me and hope that I can win them over.
You know, you have a really fascinating passage in the book about Vallejo. You had, you know, some family there who kind of started to teach you the ropes of growing up in Vallejo. And you end up saying, you know, this is sort of like your conclusion. Like many second generation immigrants, I learned about our country from Black people. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, Vallejo is an interesting place, right? Like, I think by some standards, it's the most diverse feeding America. You know, in World War II, it drew Filipino immigrants, it drew Black migrants from the South, it drew white families from the Midwest to work at the shipyard, and that sort of created this city that became known for having people from all over the country, all over the world. And yet, like so many other American cities, it's intensely segregated. So when my family moved into Vallejo, the neighborhoods we moved into were the ones that had been, you know, basically reserved for Black people. And so when I was growing up, those were sort of the people around me, you know, my not just my neighbors, but the heroes I grew up, you know, following in American culture were Black. The faces on my walls from Tupac, you know, Allen Iverson, I watched Spike Lee movies. The sort of culture that I learned from Black people, from Black artists and Black athletes who grew up in these circumstances that are not in a lot of the American textbooks that they teach around the world in America, that was the story I learned, the story of a country rooted to its injustices, a country of redlining and of segregation and of oppression, which very much contrasted from the country that my elders learned about, whether they learned about it in textbooks from American designed schools in the Philippines that expressed this notion of American exceptionalism. You know, they sort of had this image based on Tell, which is a story of open arms, a story of ever upward progress, while the America I learned about was about one that a country that is still battling for its own soul.
Yeah. I mean, let's just dive in there with your mom. I mean, this, I can't imagine, to be honest with you, writing with as much like depth and intensity as you do about your relationship with your mom. Maybe tell us how you grew up with her first before we get into sort of how your politics diverged.
Yeah, it was a single mother only child relationship. So we were very, very close, you know, attached at the hip in many ways. And, you know, we traveled a lot. And over the course of our travels, she would sort of be this whirling dervish of wanting to try new experiences, while I'd always sort of be this conservative check mark on her, where I'd sort of tell her, well, you know, maybe we need to leave early so we can make this flight, or maybe we don't have time to catch, you know, go to this next museum. Maybe we should just relax. And so we sort of developed this partnership where she would always kind of push the bounds and I would sort of try to reel her in. And we sort of played off of each other in that sense. And I think with a lot of these kind of relationships where it's just one mother and one child, you sort of develop this polar contrast to where I sort of develop strengths in relation to her weaknesses and vice versa. So we were really close and we talked about everything and a lot of my worldviews, from the religion I grew up with to the kind of the basic understanding of reality that I had, was all filtered through her.
Huh. And when did you start to realize that things were, that you were starting to diverge from her, both, you know, in that sort of natural way of parent from child, but also maybe in these sort of larger, more political ways?
That began in the first term of the Obama administration. To that point, my mom hadn't really paid too much attention to politics, and neither had I. You know, 08 was the first election and I was old enough to vote in. And so I got interested in learning about these candidates. I threw support behind Obama. I convinced my mom to as well. And things had sort of gone on as they had before, which is that we were kind of on the same side. But during that first term, as the Tea Party begins to emerge, and as more of the right wing begins to push against Obama's policies, my mom learns that Obamacare covers some abortions. And so she feels a bit betrayed because, you know, true to her Catholic teachings, abortion was the number one issue that she cared about. And when she found that the candidate we had both supported was pro-life, she began to realize that maybe I wasn't the most trusted person in terms of where she should believe in politics. And then over the next 5, 6, 7 years, as she listened to more Fox News and got deeper into right-wing media ecosystems, she began to echo those points more and more, while I began to kind of go further on the other side as I began to learn more about the world and learn more about American history and learn more about American oppressions. So it was sort of this moment where both of us began to have these contrasting opposite enlightenments simultaneously.
Hmm. And would you... I mean, one of the things, just knowing the amount of reporting that BuzzFeed News, like your colleagues there, did on that right-wing media ecosystem, were you just like going to your friends at BuzzFeed being like, you know, my mom just said this thing to me Are you seeing, is that out there in that, in you know, the fringes of the right-wing media ecosystem?
I would, you know, I always felt a bit ahead of the curve. You know, I think that was one of the blessings, as frustrating as it would be sometimes to argue with my mom over basic facets of reality. I did feel that I had this understanding of the world that I might not otherwise have, just being ensconced in my own, you know, New York City bubble. And seeing kind of what are the things that people across the country believe. I'd hear about it from my mom, and then like 2-3 weeks later, I'd see it written about, you know, on BuzzFeed News or anywhere else. So I did feel like she sort of gave me this. And I think that's in many ways one of the reasons we've been able to maintain this very respectful, loving relationship, is that, you know, our perspectives to each other have always been, while we may disagree, we will still always listen to each other, because what she believes, half the country believes pretty much. What I believe, half the country believes pretty much. And we both still find it important to know what that other half thinks.
Yeah, I mean, that part is so fascinating to me, because you obviously have this, you know, incredibly rich relationship with your mom on an emotional level, but you're kind of able to bring the same kind of structural understanding of where she's getting her information to bear in that relationship, which seems like it makes it a little bit easier to sort of, you know, sit down and talk and have dinner.
I think so, you know, and I mean, it makes it easier just from the sense that there's not much sort of uncertainty on my end. I no longer have to ask this, how do you know this? It's kind of just there, and it's kind of clear. And it does help me knowing that, I mean, counterintuitively, so many other people believe the same thing, even though that can be a bit depressing to think about. The fact that she's not just sort of some rogue actor, you know, going off on her own, but part of this wide, maybe even growing community of people that get their news sources from these non-credible outlets. And I think it sort of helped me to understand the fact that it's not just a matter of like sending her a New York Times story disputing the fact that she claims, because I knew that, you know, the kind of the source itself was poisoned from the root. And it wasn't about giving her the right information, because it was about kind of where that information was coming from. And the sources that I was citing, she gave no credence to, just as the sources that she was citing, I gave no credence to.
Did it change your journalism? Like, it changed the way that you wrote stories?
Yeah, I think so. I think it goes both ways, right? In one sense, I think my journalism changed the way I have a relationship with my mom, because so much of my job over the last decade has been going into communities and talking to people whose beliefs I don't necessarily agree with. And I think knowing that, it's one thing to go into a place, you know, to go into some small town in Mississippi and talk to folks who say things that I find racist. It's one thing to tell yourself, oh, well, this is still someone's mother, daughter, child. I should respect them. It's another thing to know, oh, this person believes exactly what my mom believes. You know, it gave me an empathy, I think, that I might not have had I just been coming in without the knowledge of my mom's belief. And then on the other side of the token, I think my mom's belief allowed me to ask questions to those sources that I might not have thought to ask if I hadn't had all these conversations with my mom, where I sort of had this base of knowledge of knowing what a lot of folks already believe.
We're talking with Albert Samaha about his memoir, Concepcion, An Immigrant Family's Fortunes. He's also an investigative journalist and the inequality editor for BuzzFeed News. And we want to hear your family's migration stories, particularly if it's from the Philippines to the Bay. Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email forum at kqed.org or get in touch. Twitter and Instagram, KQED Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Be back with more after the break. Welcome back to Forum. We're talking with Albert Samaha about his memoir, Concepcion, An Immigrant Family's Fortunes. He's a journalist, investigative journalist and inequality editor for BuzzFeed News. And we would love to hear from you. Tell us about your family's migration story from the Philippines to the Bay. And what Filipino-American stories and contributions do you feel really haven't gotten their due? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can email your questions to forum at kqed.org or on Twitter and Instagram. Look us up, KQED Forum. Albert, I wanted to get into this family migration story, which is really an epic in this memoir, of this, all of these different family members coming and going, returning to the Philippines and coming back to the U.S. Where do we center this? Would it really be on the apartment in, you know, Western Addition? Is that kind of the centerpiece for you of this entire sort of migration epic?
I think so, for a couple of reasons, right? And in one sense, it's the first property that my family ever had or moved into in California. And it also sort of represented in some ways our American dream. You know, I think for us, you know, living in Vallejo and San Mateo and other aspects of the Bay, San Francisco was always the place we wanted to end up. And that house always represented sort of this idea of we came, we started in San Francisco, and then we quickly realized it was too expensive of a city for us to live in. And so we moved elsewhere. And sort of this idea of always the second generation, my generation, wanting to return to San Francisco, to us always symbolized this idea of aspiring and reaching to the American life that our parents came here for. I think that house is definitely kind of the central point there, kind of the opposite end of the spectrum to our family house in Vallejo, which ended up being kind of the way station for all the arrivals.
Yeah. How did the family decide to come over?
So we were a upper middle class family in the Philippines back in the 70s and the 60s. And I think growing up, I had initially assumed that they had just left because of the Ferdinand Marcos dictatorship. You know, a lot of people left the country during that time because they felt the structures of the dictatorship were becoming too tight. But I later learned that it had predated that, that even at their kind of peak wealth in the Philippines in the mid-60s, America was always the dreamland. They had grown up going to schools designed by Americans with American teachers and American syllabuses and American textbooks. And they had grown up learning that America was the place to be, that no matter how high you aspire to reach in the Philippines, there will always be another step. And that step is to reach the empire, to become part of the empire, to go from being a colonized people in a colonized country to a colonist people in the empire that kind of runs the world. And so it had always kind of been their dreams, even before any setbacks, even before any struggles they had in the Philippines, they had long aspired to come to the exceptional nation.
Yeah. And who brings them there ultimately, or who could orchestrate it?
So it's a long chain of events with a bunch of dominoes falling, right? The first of my blood to come was my grandauntie Caridad, who served for the Allied forces in the underground resistance in the Philippines, fighting the Japanese occupation. That earned her a visa and a job in San Francisco working for the U.S. Army's Veterans Administration's office. She lived there for about 20 years. No one else in my family can come because at this point, immigration restrictions are still in place, blocking everyone from outside of Northern and Western Europe. Then in 1965, the gates open, anyone can come. And that's when my grandmother and grandfather applied for the green cards, got their visas, and then eventually came over. So it was in the late 1970s when my grandmother finally settled in, moved in, and my aunties and uncles began to come. And then over the 70s, 80s, and 90s was kind of when the exodus happened, until eventually by the time I was born in 1989, nearly all of my aunties and uncles were in the Bay Area.
Yeah. I mean, the member of your family that's sort of like the ultimate avatar for maybe things would have been better back home is your Uncle Spanky. Can you just, where do we start with Uncle Spanky? I mean, do we start with him as a rock star back home in the Philippines? Maybe that's a good place to start. Like, how did... who was Uncle Spanky, and what was he up to in the Philippines?
Yeah, he was a rock star. He was part of a band called VST and Company, which is a very famous disco band. People call it the Bee Gees of the Philippines. In the Philippines, and we see this now with folks like Manny Pacquiao, when you're a celebrity in the Philippines, that goes across the board. You know, you act, you sing, you dance, you host television shows, you host movies, you star in movies. So he was doing all of the above. He was hosting a live sketch comedy show. He was starring in movies. He was touring the country with his band, kind of the full red carpet treatment, performing in Malacanang Palace for the dictator, and kind of had everything someone in the Philippines could possibly hope for. You know, a big house in a compound with a bunch of maids and drivers, private school for the kids, you know, a beach house on the coast, and I think you're right. He is sort of an avatar for this idea that I was exploring of, you know, why would you leave comfortable circumstances in the homeland in order to come to an America that by the time I was born seemed to be in economic decline, seemed to have widening inequality, seemed to be a place that wasn't welcoming those of us that were coming in of a darker skin. And so it was always sort of, he was sort of the key to me to answering that question of why he would come.
We're talking with Albert Smaja about his memoir, Concepcion, An Immigrant Family's Fortunes. I'd love to hear your family's migration story, particularly if you came from Philippines here to the San Francisco Bay Area. Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email's forum at kqed.org, or you can get in touch on Twitter and Instagram. You can look us up, KQED Forum. So what was the answer that Spanky would give you to why he gave all that up?
It's for his kids. For his kids, like so many other immigrants. You know, he says that no matter what he had in the Philippines, he believed that America could give his kids more. You know, he believed that it was sort of a gilded cage where you could have all this wealth and success, but all it takes is one dictator who doesn't like you to take all that away, as happened to so many wealthy people in the Philippines during the Marcos dictatorship. You know, he was frustrated by the bribes he had to pay at customs and at the post office. He was frustrated by the fact that he had to have a bodyguard everywhere he went and that his friends thought he was a fool for not carrying a gun. So there was all these constraints. He believed that no matter how much success he could have in the Philippines, he didn't want his kids to have to kind of go through these same constraints. And he believed that eventually, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, when we talk about the sacrifices immigrants make, you know, they don't come in naive totally, you know, like they know it's going to be hard. He knew it was going to be hard. He knew that it was going to be a setback. He knew he wasn't going to be as wealthy and famous in the States as he was in the Philippines. But he was willing to put up with that sacrifice because he did believe that, you know, even the children of a rock star in the Philippines would not have as good of a life as the children of a baggage handler in California. And that was sort of the premise on which he based that entire sacrifice.
You know, I mean, one of the things that this really resonated with me because of my own family's experience and, you know, just talking with my dad, I mean, I think Spanky's line, direct quote there was, whatever successes you do in the Philippines, there's always a price to pay. And the question I feel like so much of this book explores is like, well, what is that price? And it struck me that like with Spanky, there was the violence and all that stuff, but there was also maybe this deeper, like when we talk about corruption, you know, we're often talking about like bribes and things like that, but there's kind of a deeper corruption of knowing you're part of this ruling elite in a country with such extreme poverty as well. I mean, did you sense that was also part of it, of just like kind of like, God, like what would happen to my soul if I, you know, am at my beach, you know, villa while all these other things are going on around me?
That's a really good point, and I think that's absolutely true. You know, he was one of the people who did well during the dictatorship. You know, the Marcos loved his music and had his band come in and play. You know, his family is from Ilocos in the northern part of the Philippines, which is where Marcos is from. And his family had connections with the Marcos family, you know, through ancestral history. So I do think there is this idea of, and I think this idea actually it resonates very much with me as being an American now, this idea of what is your duty when you find you are complicit with the oppressor.
Totally.
You know, if you are benefiting from that, that's great. You know, what is the point of life if not to benefit from circumstances around you? But when that blood might be on your hands and might always be on your hands, if that is always the cost you have to pay, is that really something that you want to pass on?
Yeah. Yeah, and just what that does to a person to keep up with that. I mean, you know, I was curious about, you know, how do you see yourself in this kind of wave of Filipino migration that occurs? Because your family's kind of coming over right as lots of other Filipino immigrants are also coming over, yeah?
Yeah, the year I was born, Filipinos were the second highest diasporic arrivals behind Mexican immigrants. So we came right at the peak.
Yeah. And did you end up finding that because you had this sort of growing wave, there was sort of a Filipino culture and a Filipino American culture that was unfolding around you that didn't exist for, you know, Spanky or your mom. When they were coming up, there weren't nearly as many Filipinos as when you were growing up.
You know, the reality is that statistically that is true, but it didn't feel like it at the time. And I think I was surprised when I found out how many Filipinos are in America as I got older and like looked into the numbers and all this and that. I mean, we're the fourth largest diaspora in the U.S. today, but I think still very much underrepresented in a lot of respects for a couple of reasons. One is that Filipino people didn't have to form as tight enclaves as folks that came from countries that didn't speak English, right? Filipinos grew up in a country that had been an American colony since the early 20th century. So they learned English. They knew the American culture that they grew up watching. You know, they listened to Elvis and the Beatles. Well, I guess the Beatles aren't American, but they listened to Western music and Western culture from their childhood. So by the time Filipinos came to America, it was very easy for us to assimilate. We knew the language, we knew the culture, we knew what was expected of us. And I think the goal for Filipinos, for maybe any people that has been colonized for 400 years, is that you know that life is better to be colonist than to be colonized, and so you strive to assimilate. So I actually think this is why there are fewer Manila towns, you know, across the country than there are, you know, Chinatowns or Little Italy's or a lot of different other ethnic enclaves, because our aim was always to blend in. And I think the consequence of that we sort of see today, or maybe we don't see, we sort of see in its absence, is that from whether it's just speaking about, you know, Asian American canons and media representation that focus more on East Asians and South Asians than on Filipinos, or just on like how many, you know, movie stars do you know that are Filipino? How many, you know, newscasters do you see that are Filipino? Like how many just outwardly Filipino people do you see around you? For me, at least, it was always a lot less than what the numbers actually reflected.
Let's bring in Sarah from Hayward.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is really just when I hear these stories, when I hear your dialogue, it's just I am so proud, and I have so much love hearing about this. I love hearing about your mother, and it makes me feel like stories of my own grandmother, my own mother and grandmother, and their yearning to come to America. I find that when I share my stories of my parents, I was born here. My mother and father both came here from the Philippines in the 80s. Whether I share my stories with other Filipino Americans, mostly really Filipino Americans, I find that I feel they almost downplay and kind of just like, oh yeah, that's the typical story I hear. You know, my dad dropped out of college, joined the Navy to come here. And then my mother came here as a registered nurse, and they both met in San Francisco and got married. And when I share that story, you know, they came like many other Filipinos, many other immigrants, couple hundred dollars in their pocket, one bag of clothes, and they made this beautiful life here. And I find that when I share that story with people, it's, oh, that's, yeah, that's typical. Oh, yeah, my parents did that too. And I'm just like beaming with such pride and joy that my parents have, because they're so proud, you know, of the life that they gave my sister and I. My dad brought over his eight other siblings, and my mom has, you know, five other siblings she brought here. And I just wonder if you've heard that as well from other immigrants.
You needed a rock star uncle, Sarah. you need the rock star just to bring a little, you know, a little pizzazz to the story. You can you just borrow Spanky in your actual telling of your story.
I know.
What do you think, Albert? Like, is it almost like too common to have had, you know, a relatively successful Filipino, you know, immigrant experience?
I mean, the numbers show that that is the standard, right? Is that Filipinos, in part because of our capacity for assimilation and our language skills coming in, are one of the most successful immigrant diasporas in America economically. But I think the question, and I think we all should be proud of that. And I think this is why our elders came. And I think, you know, most immigrant elders I speak with will say they don't regret it. But I think the question that always drew my curiosity was why we had to assimilate, why we had to immigrate in the first place. You know, it's sort of, we're basing all of this upward trajectory on this paradigm of things would have been worse in the Philippines. The question is why? Why did we have to leave? Why did we have to leave and experience the setbacks that so many other families don't have to experience? And I think that's kind of the heart of what I thought to answer in the book, is that there's this history of colonization, that the Philippines is one slice of a much larger pie that is a part of. And the country that we came to and withstood those setbacks in, America, played a big role in the disinvestment.
Yeah. Let's bring in caller Edgar from San Francisco. Welcome to the show, Edgar.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
Hey, good morning.
Great show. Thank you. I'm inspired by everything that I heard, which is why I called in.
What's your family story?
So my family immigrated to San Francisco in the 1950s. My mother's side of the family immigrated after my grandfather, who fought in World War II. He immigrated to the United States, brought his family here, was stationed in Washington, made his way over to San Francisco. And my father actually met my mother on the boat from the Philippines to San Francisco. Immigrated at the same time, you know, very romantic story, to say the very least. My father came as an educated person, wanted to make a better life for himself in the United States. And he and my mother met on the boat to San Francisco. And he moved on to Los Angeles. And my mother and her family stayed in San Francisco, and they stayed in touch and eventually got married. So I'm a second.
Yeah,
thank you. I'm a second generation Filipino American. I was born in the 60s, and the person who took my call asked me, well, why is it important for you to retain your roots and your culture? And it's important for me because I started to tell her a story about how when I'm around like Filipinos from the Philippines, they often say, you're not really Filipino. You don't sound Filipino. You don't act Filipino. You don't have the same mannerisms of, you know, somebody from the Philippines. And then yet when I'm around my non-Filipino friends and colleagues, they'll say, oh yeah, you're Filipino. They identify me as Filipino. So it's a interesting contrast. And, you know, for me, it's important for me to stay connected with my roots, especially as a second generation Filipino American.
Thank you so much, Edgar. Really appreciate that. We have been talking with Albert Samaha about his memoir Concepcion and Immigrant Family's Fortunes. And as you can hear, he's inspired some incredible storytelling from our listeners as well. Thank you so much, Albert.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Just wanted to say, we're playing you out with Uncle Spanky's band in the background. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.